Okay, welcome to Sparm Chatter Live number 5 with special guests on the main line. Fred McDowell, or as you'll find out soon, maybe his real name. We'll be discussing his blog on the main line, which you can still check out. All his posts are still up. Some really, really good stuff on there. It's not updated really anymore. We'll ask him that when he comes on. Let's see if we can get this one sorted out. The only problem I think with these lives are everyone, the guests have a problem getting linked in. It's like a bit of an issue over here. Not sure why. Right. People can turn on to comment. Why is that happening? Everyone should turn on to please comment. You'd be able to comment. Do you know where someone said, I think you go to your settings, maybe Periscope. I don't know. You have to click on. A couple of people have been seeing this the past few shows. Everyone's responding to the tweet. I'm not going to see that till after because all I see now is my face on this video. And I can't access anything else on my phone. So, actually, you have to put the screen in big, and there you go, settings and connect to Periscope. And if you put the screen up, you'll be able to connect to comment. Okay, we're still waiting for Fred to join. I'm not sure. He should have gotten a link. Now we'll have to restart, but hopefully, he'll be able to get on. There he goes. Now he joined. Let's see if he's joining a Nicole. There we go. We got
So everyone feel free to comment and ask questions. All right, Fred, you're live.
Goodness, here I am. Do you hear me?
I hear you. It's a bit fuzzy, but you're there.
Maybe I should take off my headphone. Let's see.
Try with
Acceptable?
that.
Okay, hang on a second. Can you hear me?
Little better.
Okay, now you're a bit fuzzy. Okay.
One of us will be fuzzy. All right.
Somebody
Okay, so
has to be fuzzy. Yeah, sorry.
thanks for joining. Okay, so do you want to tell everyone what your name is, or we're going to go with Fred McDowell? Like, when I ask for questions, the number one thing everyone wants to know is what's his name?
Ha, interesting. Well, my name is Shimon Steinmetz, but you can go with Fred McDowell. People know me as Fred. I still remember the first time someone called me Fred in person. I, almost looked around. But yeah, that's it.
Okay, and on the main line, which is the name of your excellent former current blog, and Fred McDowell, they're together. Where's that from?
Well, yeah, they are together. Let's see, how do I begin? So basically, when I began blogging, it was like Internet 1.0. I know that my tech friends are listening and not going to believe that, but back then anonymity was extraordinary. You know, was extremely common. People used pseudonyms, so that seemed natural. And when I set up a blog, I felt like I maybe would have something to say. I needed a name for the blog. I needed a name for myself. So hold on a second. I think I'm getting that feedback thing that David was talking about the other night.
All
Hold
right, so
on.
put on your headphones. See, it's fine. Let's see if that helps.
How's this? Am I audible?
Yeah, you're fine. If you don't have the feedback, do it like this. You're wearing
Yeah,
headphones now?
this is a little preferable. Okay, so basically, I decided I'm gonna start a blog about 15 years ago, and it was around Purim time. The intention was that I was gonna call it Kimu v'Kiblu. Very, get it? Kimu v'Kiblu.
Yeah,
So,
not a great name.
exactly. So what happened was, for a few days after Purim, I couldn't really set it up, so I had to think of a new name. So the name that I thought of was Gimme Shelter, which is the name of an old Rolling Stone song, and I thought to myself, this is shelter, this is like my blog. And I blogged there for a couple of weeks, and then I switched platforms. This, I think, was called Blog City, which you could tell from the name it wasn't going to last.
Yeah, no.
Yeah,
Before
so
my time.
I switched to Blogger, and I needed a name, and gimmeshelter.blogspot.com was taken, so I needed a new name. So at the time, I was listening to a song by an old blues musician named Mississippi Fred McDowell that I really liked. And the song was called Jesus on the Main Line. And I strategically left that part off, and I called myself on the main line.
Yeah, you left out the first part.
It was, you see how much thought I put into everything? So, so I call myself on the main line. Somehow it felt comfortable to me. And apparently there's a neighborhood in Philadelphia called the main line, I think.
I was going to say, I learned in Philly. And when I was on the main line blog, I thought like you're from Philly or something. Because that's so like the main line.
Yeah. So over the years, I got many people have asked me, oh, you're from Philly. I know you're from Philly. And it took a while till I put two and two together. But that's it. Yeah.
Gotcha. So that's how the blog started. So I guess that started pretty much the beginning. Also, so what do you do for a day job? It's everyone wants to know. You always have these blog, and we'll get to also your really cool snippets and pieces that you put up. But what do you actually do as a job?
I do things that are pretty much closely related to my blogging. It wasn't or research. It wasn't something I always did. I won't bore you with what I used to do, but I do research. I edit. I do auction cataloging for rare books, Judaica and Hebraica. There's still, this and that kind of thing.
So you do kind of what you do online is kind of what you do similar to what you do as a real job.
Yeah, it's all intertwined. It's, mixed in. Client.
Right. Okay. So I think we should jump back. We'll get back to that later. I think let's jump back to the blog because that's really where everyone probably knows you from originally on here. It's where I found you back in the day as Yeshiva Bacher. When you started the blog, what was your intention? Just to have a blog to put your thoughts online back in the day? What was your intention?
Well, you're very good at anticipating answers because, that was it to begin with. I mean, basically, there was a time when blogging was a new medium. It was exciting and vibrant. And I frequently commented in a lot of other people's blogs for maybe a year or so. And then, suddenly had an epiphany that if I have things to say in response to other people, I might have things to say on my own. You could just start one. So I did. And for a while, probably 6 months, maybe a year, it was very much old school, posting a link to an old article, posting a link to an article with a little introduction to it. These are my thoughts. And then engaging in the comments. And then over time, the focus kind of shifted to the things that I was deeply interested in, different kinds of history questions and solutions and little finds that I thought I wanted to share with the world. And that kind of became what it mainly was.
Right. And that's how it kind of continued.
Olamino cartoons, yes.
Yeah, Olamino cartoons.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. Now, when did you really stop? I know there's been some posts over the past couple of years, but nothing really. When... And why did you stop? You stopped just because blogging as a medium died and everybody moved to social media? Is that really it?
Yeah, I mean, that's part of it. I'm looking at my blog right now, and I can see the number of posts per year. 252 in 2011, 207 in 2012. The last, basically, 2000, I'm not going to go bore you with all the years. I mean... Right. It was partly because everybody moved to social media, but the main thing for me was the loss of commenting. That was the treat. That was, the candy. That was my reward. Right. That people would comment and then I would get engaged, and I kind of fed on that. And people stopped commenting, and they were reading. I mean, I always, had access to my statistics. And I knew people were reading. I could see people were on, what posts they were reading. But, I started to realize they're not talking about it on my blog. They're talking about it on Facebook. So, that's where I went. And I did try to keep it up. I'm looking. I see 2014 had 35 posts, 2015 had 11. And I did. I told myself I wouldn't stop. But you know how these things are.
Right. But they mean the shape. The shame is that as good as and interesting as your Facebook posts and Twitter posts are, they're not like in-depth articles that you had there. Like, and you don't ever want to write stuff like that anymore.
Wow. This has just turned into the hot seat.
Everybody wants to know this, by
I'll
the way.
Answer, I'll answer. I know it's fine. I'll answer. The truth is that I still do in-depth research. Once in a while on Facebook, I'll post something that in a way is like an old school essay or post or something like that. So the answer is, yeah, you know, I mean, I have, you know, plans. I have, you know what I mean? But actualizing them is not necessarily the same thing. I don't know. I guess, you go through different phases in your life. Right. I remember about a year ago, I prepared a real post, a nice post for a certain website that's going to remain nameless. So they did nothing wrong. It was a Purim post. I said, I'm going to push myself to get this thing out there. It was basic. Do you want to know what it was? I mean, it was basically a nice essay. And I remember I shared the document with one of the editors, and then I never heard back from him. And then it was Purim. So I thought, okay. But then a year later, I was going through my, my Google Docs, and I saw that he, or my emails, and I saw that he had actually sent me a request to view the document that somehow I didn't get.
Oh my.
So like it wasn't his fault, you know, maybe that's curve. But yeah, so, you know, I don't know. We'll see.
And so you're not planning on restarting, essentially. But let me ask you, let me piggyback on that, is you kind of joined this forum blog, right? So would you post anything ever there as a post or no?
Would I? I mean, I'm not against it. I do other work for this forum blog. The best I can say is that, you know, people go through phases in life, and if I get the bug again, you'll know it. You'll see it.
Right. No, it's just asking for everybody wants to know. Now, and another question that I've gotten a bunch of times, and I had the same question, is would you consider taking, you know, editing some of the best posts on there and putting it into a book? Because there really is material there on your blog that could and should be made into a book. Would you think about doing that?
Oh, yeah, I've definitely thought about it. I mean, the truth is, it's probably material for several books, and I have a lot of other material besides. Probably comes down to dollars and cents. Somebody wants to sponsor it. Maybe I'll take the time to do it.
Right.
Yes.
Gotcha. So now getting back to the blog, even more so with the blog, anyone who reads your blog, and in general, you, especially the blog, I don't know so much anymore on social media, but you have a real fascination with Shaddal. So maybe you want to, I would tell you to tell people who Shaddal is, but most people listening to this probably know who he is. Where did your fascination with him start?
Well, so there's a, like you said, most people know who Shaddal is. Do they? I'm not sure. Probably most people listening.
You can tell people who he is quickly.
He was, you know, he was an Italian scholar, lived in the 19th century. He was Bible commentator, researcher, historian, philologist, you know, all a gute Sachen. And is an interesting person, you know, that I find personally inspiring and interesting, and one of my favorites, you know. And there's a guy named Akiva Weisinger who, do you know who he is, Akiva?
No, I don't know who he is.
He's a good guy. He's a promising young scholar, and if he's listening, you know, tell him I said so. So recently he posted somewhere about Shaddal, and he said that he's the only, you know, Parshan with a fan base. And I thought that was very apt. So I think it is. So, you know, part of it is that, you know, he's a fascinating person. He left a vast body of work, about 1,500 pages of letters that are very interesting. He was iconoclastic. I feel like I'm not really adding very much over here. Basically, many years ago, I came across his Peres on Chumash, an edition that turned out to be somewhat censored. And the Schlesinger edition, which is printed in 1965.
And I think Monk's translation is based on that one. I know Monk's translation is also...
Yeah. It's based on that one, exactly. It's faulty, but although it has good reason for existing. I was looking through it, and it was just refreshing. I mean, His personality shines through. He's someone who is this, you know, odd mix of humble and arrogant. He also has this, you know, quirk where he fanatically cites everyone that he can, including his students. And he says things that are, you know, you can see he's really using his mind in a very critical way. And it spoke to me. And then, you know, the more I investigated and read his letters, and then I came across his Vikuach on Kabbalah, which, you know, would probably be controversial, but it's just, you know, delicious, right? Like endless bowls of ice cream, you know?
Right.
But not empty calories.
As anyone knows, now there's the really nice 5-volume edition on Torah, and then the 5-volume edition on Nach.
Yeah.
And the Torah one is really, really good, the new one. It's fantastic. So, the new edition.
Yeah, definitely. So, it has some new material and so on and so forth.
Right. So, some people are a bit scared of him, though, because of the quote-unquote, you know, maskil. Fira, whatever. So, what would you say to people like that? Like, if they would say that?
You know, I wouldn't tell anybody to read what they don't want to read, but I will say,
I mean, if someone is thinking about it, you know, open-minded, obviously you go into reading Shaddal open-minded, and, you know, not only that, maybe careful, so to speak, for most people, but even so, like, what would you tell them? Like,
yeah, I mean, you know, like I said, he was iconoclastic, and the truth is, in the circles which he operated, I would tell him two things, actually. The first is that within his context as, you know, an Italian scholar, he was actually not that different from the Italian Masora, which included a lot of openness and looking at a lot of non-traditional material and incorporating that. So to begin with,
Maranayim, right?
Go back to Maranayim. I mean, the Ramchal, you know, most people in think of him as, you know, Mesilas Yesharim, but, you know, he wrote secular plays and rhetoric and all kinds of things. So this was actually not...
Right, I think Ramesh Zakut has a sefer based on Dante, so...
Exactly. Yeah, I always say that, I always say this, what's his name, Rabbi Shmuel HaKohen, who was one of the quote-unquote firmest Italian Rabbanim in the 18th century. So, you know, when Wesley...
Is that Rassiklaren? Is his? Which one is
no, that? No, it was... he wrote the show Zera MS.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
Zera MS. So he was... let me see. So, you know, the story with Naftali Hertz Wesley, right? He wrote Divrei Shalom VeEmes, which was about educational reform, infamous, yeah. Exactly.
With the Nebuchadnezzar,
So, you know, he personally, Wesley personally was associated with the Western Sfaradim, where that type of approach in education was, you know, was normal, right? It's like, I'm not going to give contemporary analogies, but it was completely normal, and it created a firestorm, and he apparently was very shocked. So he thought that the Italian Jews, as far as he understood them, was kind of like a place where he can find support. So he sent letters, he sent the books and letters to all the rabbis in Italy, you know, the leading rabbis, and every single one of them, with the exception of one, supported him. You know, he was saying, that their way of life, was appropriate for Central Europe. And the one rabbi who dissented was this Rabbi Shmuel HaKohen, because he had an objection too. So he was quote unquote the firmest, but, you know, he wrote poetry where he refers to Ulysses and other Greek gods. I mean, it was a different culture entirely. So the first thing is, in his own context, he wasn't swimming, against the current as much. And the second thing I would say is that within his other context, which was that he was part of a circle of the so-called maskilim, you know, in Galicia Germany.
He has a lot of letters to Shear, right?
Yeah, absolutely. He was one of the leading, you know, scholars of that, you know, so-called movement. The thing is that he was also the, again, quote-unquote, firmest of all of them. He was deeply pious. He constantly tried to knock down their icons, and he argued this against this and that. And the truth of the matter is that he was an unusual person that can't be easily placed into a box. And I think it's worth looking into. You know, it's not going to bite if you read a little Shaddal.
Right, and anybody that's interested in getting into Shaddal, you would suggest starting with the Pirush on Alatar, right?
Yeah, I think the Pirush Alatar is very accessible. I think it's beautiful. I think people will find a lot of beauty and personality in there. A lot of critical thinking. Nothing crazy that would offend anybody. You never know. But I think that would be a good place to start. Another good place to start is if anybody can find his Pirush on Yeshayahu.
Now it's in the set, I think.
You can buy it is, yeah. Yes, yeah. It's interesting because, you know, to some degree, I'm a person of my era, and there's clearly been a Shaddal revival in the past 15 to 20 years.
And Dan Klein translated Bereshis and Shemais now. You can get in English.
Absolutely. I mean, although he began doing that in the 70s. He's a friend of mine, Dan. And it's a labor of love for him.
Do you see the question that someone just asked, by the way?
yeah, I did see it.
Okay, keep going.
Okay, well, what is that? You know, YOLO, right? I learned in Chaim Berlin. I also learned for a time in Shariyashiv. And that's pretty much it. I mean, I don't know if I need to go any deeper than that. You know, I can tell you where I went to for kindergarten, but I don't think it's that necessary.
No. Okay, sorry. I cut off Shaddal. So you're saying that the one in Yeshaya, you think also?
I'm sorry? Say that again?
You were saying about Shaddal that you think also on Yeshaya, somewhere you would suggest people to look at.
Oh, yeah. So the introduction to Yeshaya, it's very short. It's probably two or three pages. He has an essay where he lists, I think the number is 9 or maybe 11 or 13, whatever, some number of the qualities that that somebody who writes a parish on Tanakh should have.
Oh, wow.
And of course, he's talking about, you know, he acts like he's talking about other people, but if you read it and you know about him, you see that he's talking about himself. And that's as much a programmatic essay. He actually has a couple of programmatic essays. But the introduction to Yeshaya was pretty fascinating, again, because of the way he blends, you know, what you would call scholarship and his particular brand of traditional piety and reverence for the text and for our tradition and so on and so forth.
Right. Interesting. So they should stay away from Kehelas to start, right?
Yeah, the truth is he barely has a Pirush on Kehelas. I mean, it's, you know, look, if you want to stick to, you know, traditional, I'm just gonna laugh. I mean, Kehelas, okay, yes, I'm gonna give the spoiler. He doesn't think Shlomo HaMelech wrote Kehelas.
We had this fight on Twitter last year, right? Someone called him a kofer from that. Whatever.
Yeah. In fact, there's even a place in I think it's either, no, it's a story about the Shoyal Hamesha, right? Of Yosef Shaul Nathanson.
Yeah.
So somebody, don't remember right now, somebody writes a story about him, the Talmud of his. He said that one time he was, the Shoyal Hamesha was considering some type of difficult question about Gittin. And he said he needed to look in Oyev Ger, Shaddal's, you know,
On
Targum Onkelos, exactly. Not only is it a classic, he was practically the first person to get there. You know, like Onkelos was, you know, people just kind of read Onkelos or learned or translated Onkelos, but there wasn't very many commentaries on it. He wrote a commentary, he got there before a lot of people. And so the Shlomo Mesher says he needs a copy to try to answer this halachic question. So he tells this Talmud to go over to so-and-so who has it in his library and bring it to me. So the person said to him, to the Shlomo Mesher, excuse me, the person says to him, you know, well, Sato, you know, like he's not so this, he's not so that. So his answer was, you know, sometimes we need it. And that's what he said. So, yeah. Maybe you need even more than sometimes.
Okay. So the other thing that's... Yeah. Probably covers Shaddal pretty much over here. So nowadays you're on Twitter, Facebook, and you post a lot of obscure quotes, newspaper clippings, things from random books or Sfarim, pictures, everything. Where do you find that stuff, and how do you find that stuff? We lost you there. Hello?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, now I can hear you. Sorry, go ahead. You're like fading in and out. Hello? You want to hang up and try again? Yeah, convenient timing. Fred, I think we lost you. Did you join again? Let's see.
Oh, there you go. He's off. Okay. Call back again. Ask to rejoin so we can add you back again. Not sure what happened there. Right at the perfect time. What everyone wanted to know about the stuff you post here. There you go. Okay. Hung up. And now request to join again. There we go. We'll get you back up in a minute.
There we go. It's in. Has a 5-second countdown once you add the person. You're back on. What happened
Hi,
there?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, now you're back on. I know we lost you right when I asked you about where you get all your stuff. Can you hear me now or no? Do you want to try again?
Yes. Hold on 1 second. Can you hear me?
Yeah, right here. We have you.
Okay. So yes, we're finding things. I mean, I kind of operate under the theory that the past was deeply interesting and weird and similar in many ways to the present and dissimilar. And I find in many, many sources these things that fell through the cracks. Either people don't remember them or somebody did us. Somebody once did an authoritative study of this safer or something like that. And nobody ever looked at that again. But I find if you turn, you know, to a certain page, there's something really interesting over there. So I find that social media is a great medium for sharing these things. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. No, it is. But the question is, how in the world do you find a random newspaper clipping from 1921?
Hi, I'm sorry. You're cutting out?
Do you have me now? You hear me now?
I do have you now, but do you have me?
I do, yes. So how do you find a random newspaper clipping from 1921? How do you find that? Okay, not sure why we're having connectivity issues, but let's exit
again. Okay. Now, join back again, because I don't know really what's going on over here. Still have a lot more to get to. One, this is weird, is it? There we go. Got you back again.
Is it from my end? It could be my fault, but Fios says it's working. Okay, I don't know. It might be my fault, but it seems like it's working on my end. Do you hear me?
Can you hear me? I hear you now.
Yeah, now I do. Yes, okay. I do. I don't know. One of our services probably is bad, Wi-Fi or something.
Yeah. This is the part we're going to edit out. So what's the question? How do I find things?
Yeah, how do you find these random newspaper clippings from 1921? How do you find that? Like, how do you get to that?
Okay, so a lot of these things. I mean, of course, in my life, I've visited libraries and looked through bound volumes of periodicals, but that's not mainly how I do it. There are digital archives. A great deal of material is online.
Right.
Not too many people are reading them. And I read them or I search for things that I'm looking for. Sometimes one thing leads to another, you know?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I know how that is.
Google books and Hebrew books and various other kinds of newspaper archives and so on and so forth. I mean, just because something happened one time 130 years ago, it doesn't mean we shouldn't look at it again. So.
Right. And if something catches your eye, you just save it, write it down, and you post it eventually, that type of thing.
Yeah, or sometimes I'm researching something, a bigger question, and things come up like that. Yeah.
Right. And mainly you were posting this on Facebook. And then about, it was a year ago, maybe a little more, you joined Twitter, right?
Yes. Yeah. I actually had joined Twitter 10 years ago, but I never used it. Yeah.
So who got you to join us over here and actually be here posting, tweeting, and what made you actually do that?
So, you know, like I said, I joined Twitter, I think it was in 2010.
That's like everyone else. I had an account in 2009.
Yeah, exactly. I thought I was going to promote, you know, my blog. I would post a link, but you know, that's not how you use Twitter.
No.
It never clicked with me. It just wasn't my, it was like Pepsi, you know, the wrong brand. And I think it was in December 2018, I guess. So I was talking to my friend, Michelle Chesner, and she said somebody mentioned you on Twitter. So I said, okay, you know. And I don't think I even remember exactly. It was her. She said it. I think Deva Bashevkin sent me the link or something like that. And the particular person who mentioned me was, you probably know him or at least know him on Twitter, Yeshava Hasefer. I actually met him in person a number of years ago, but he said something like, you know, so when is Fred coming to Twitter? So I thought it would be cute to, you know, reply, you know, here I am or something like that. And you know, I started tweeting and I figured it out, and now I like Pepsi.
Yeah, what would you, do you like Facebook better, Twitter better now? Do you find there's different crowds on each one? Are they different?
Well, there's overlap, of course, but I do find there's different crowds. One thing which was nice was discovering an entirely different crowd, people who I never knew.
Right.
And something
like... I have a Facebook account. I hardly use it.
I stopped using Facebook a lot. One thing which I will say, though, is, you know, we're all ignoring the elephant... outside of us, right? We're going through a terrible time right now.
Yeah.
And I have noticed over the past week or two that I've been using Facebook a lot more. Like, I don't even know what it is. It's, you can write more words. There's some people who I go back along with. So, you know, both have uses and people. And some of my dearest friends are people that I've met on Facebook and hopefully Twitter as well.
Right. Facebook's just it's different.
I'm sorry?
Facebook, it's older. Maybe it has an older crowd. It's just, it's, I don't know. It's different. I never got used to it. I don't enjoy it really.
Yeah, but I'm older, you know.
My grandfather says on Facebook all day.
Exactly. Me, like, yeah, people. You know. Yeah. One day I'll be somebody's grandfather, you know, hopefully.
Yeah. By the way, anyone listening, if you have any questions, feel free to post them on here. So here's an interesting question. I guess you're kind of a self-made bibliophile historian, right?
Yes.
So to speak. So what mostly. Advice would you give to, whether it's Yeshiva Bacher or just or even a college student, somebody that's starting out and, you know, not taking college courses, just, you know, someone wants to build themselves up to learn about bibliography, Sfarim, history, what would you advise to them? How do they go about that?
That's a big question. So first of all, I will definitely take the label autodidact. But at the same time, it's not 1,000, you know, 100% true. I did have an early, I would like to call him a mentor, although I don't think he was aware of it at the time. When I was in college, I took a few classes with, I'll call him Moshe Rabbi Schneer Lyman.
Yeah.
And he did make a big impact on me, whether he realized it or not at the time. So it's not like I had zero exposure to a professional scholar, or anything about that. One of the best. Although, of course, when I first met him, I was so disconnected from it. I wouldn't have even began to know that, but he was important. He taught me a few things that, food for thought. But what I would recommend, I mean, you know, let's see about, I mean, follow footnotes. It's very important. You're reading something. Don't ignore the footnotes. Don't ignore the bibliography, look things up, track things down, ask questions. You know, people are, you know, many people are happy to help. happy to show off their knowledge, you know? I mean, so that's a motivator too. People want to, you know, seem smart. And if some kid asks them a question, sometimes they want to answer it, you know? I would say also find a cohort of like-minded individuals if you can. Talk things over with people. Find out what the classics are. I mean, like you said, bibliography. I mean, if you Shema Gedolim, you know.
That's a nice new addition, right? You heard about
it? Yeah, I heard about it. Yes, yeah. The guy in Beagle Eyes even asked me if I'm getting if I heard about it through you, and I said I did. He said he said Chatter. That's what he called you.
Yeah, that's what he calls me a lot. Yeah, it is. It is a really good addition. And I read Shema Gedolim in first year based medrash every night before I went to sleep. I read that in Philly. I actually went through it, and it's really enjoyable. There's Torah in there, history is everything in there. It's very important.
Right, exactly. It's very important, and putting things in context will help. I'm trying to think of something pithy to say, but I will say this: read things, follow footnotes, don't take the word of what you're reading, really, really look things up if you can. Right. Nowadays, I mean, you can look up easily 100,000 Sfarim, many old books. They're there for the taking. Follow, pay attention to details. Details matter. I would say that as well.
Right. I would add personally, I whenever I buy a safer, I always read the introduction. I find it's very helpful and important also. Even if you don't agree with the guy, but
yeah, for sure. I mean, there are things that are overlooked, and I would say to people, don't overlook those things. One more thing, like I said, not just ask people an answer to this or a recommendation. Put yourself out there, make yourself vulnerable. I mean, I remember about maybe 17 or 18 years ago, I think it was. I felt like I was becoming more interested in scholarly topics and so on and so forth. And I had a list of about a dozen people. A couple were rabbis, some were professors. They were all scholars that I admired in one way or another. And I sent them an email and I said to them, you know, what should I read? You know, what should I do? And some of them, and I have these emails, some of them, you know, what was influential to you? And most of them replied. And, you know, do that. Put yourself out there and ask people for advice.
Right. So what?
Yeah.
Is there a book or some books you would advise to, you would suggest to people that are looking to start in bibliography or history maybe as well? It doesn't have to be only bibliography. It could be history. Obviously, history is hard because there's so many different time periods, but.
Right. So, you know, this is the kind of thing where everyone has the things that they gravitate to, towards. Sure. The things that they love. I mean, to be honest, you know, the first Encyclopedia Judaica still works. If you find it, look up the top. It's a good place to start.
Right.
I never would put down Wikipedia. Of course, you know, you have to put asterisks there and caveats.
Right. Okay.
Look things up. Like I said, follow the footnotes. In terms of scholars that are accessible and engaging, to someone who really spoke to me and still does, you know, I still admire him a great deal, was Cecil Roth. He wrote books that were Jewish history books that were absolutely scholarly and also very engaging and pleasant to read.
Find your own, very popular, but they're still scholarly.
But they're very scholarly. He really had a good grasp of things. You know, you'll know it when you see it. It's hard to, you know, put it. Say, I mean, I could talk about this and that. I remember when I was, you know, 9 years old, this happened to me, and I look back on that now and I go, aha, you know, when I was 14, pay attention to these moments in your life and what inspire you. You'll find it. And if you're not going to find it, if you're not going to find it, then you're not interested. So, you know, move on to what you are interested in.
For sure. Was there a particular book or something that did inspire you? Maybe just in one area, not in every, like in one area at all?
Yeah. I mean, you want one, I can give you a couple. I mean, I remember many years ago, I was probably 13 years old, or 14. I read the R.A. Kaplan Reader.
Yeah.
And he had an article in there, which had originally been published in the Jewish Observer. It was called Treasures, and it was about book collecting letter to. You're nodding, right?
Really, I have the book. It's a really good piece.
Right. You know, it's a very good piece. And how it holds up, does it hold up? It doesn't matter. I was 13. Right. And he was talking about a fascinating thing that I didn't know existed. And I had a grandfather who I was very close with, who had many, many books in Svarm. And, you know, I started poking around there and, you know, I'd find things that fascinated me and he would talk to me about them. Like I said, a mentor of some kind. It doesn't have to be your grandfather. It could be anyone. There was a book that was important to me also as a teenager. It was called Ashkenazim and Sephardim by Hersch Jacob Zimmel. Or Zimmel, I should say, because, you know. So basically, I think he published it like in the late 50s. And it was a ridiculously ambitious book because you can't write a book of 250 pages on. I think it was called Ashkenazim and Sephardim. Their different, their relations, differences, and problems as reflected in the rabbinical responsa. So you know you can't really do that, but he had the guts to do it. Right. And so what he did was, you know, he went through 800 years of you know all the codes and Shalosh and Shuvos and so on and so forth, and he divided it into topics and he said, you know, in pronunciation this is what the Sephardim do, this is what the Ashkenazim do, and how they mourn on Tisha B'Av, this is what the Sephardim do, this is what the Ashkenazim do. And he of course included references to the scholarly journals and so on, and I thought it was fascinating. And the thing is, I remember distinctly when I was, I don't know, 14, 15, I didn't know how to read the footnotes. I didn't know what he was, you know, what these things were. The Allgemeine Zeitung des Judentums and, you know, Tarbitz and this and that and the next thing. But over the years, you know, I came back to the book and gradually it started to, not just the text, but the underlying, the way he composed it and the fact that he was not overlooking these fine details and can put together a big picture. And that was very inspiring to me. And yeah.
Right. Do you yourself, do you collect old books, antiques, or just in general old? Do you have a large library personally?
I do. Large, you know, large is relative. I would say to some degree large. I do. I mean, you know, I like old things, you know, getting back to these signposts. I remember when I was 8 years old, and again, nobody will necessarily care about this, but to me, it made a big impact. When I was 8 years old, I there was a coin store in my neighborhood, and somehow I wandered in there, and it blew me away that you can you know buy something that was from the 1800s. I mean, to me, that number seemed impossibly old. And I remember I got a coin. It was a United States penny, or it might have been a half penny or something, that had stamped 1818 on it. And that blew me away, you know, so I owned it, right. And it meant something to me. And then one time, many years later, when I was old enough to be looking through my grandfather's farm, I found one volume of Heidenheim Chumash, Wolf Heidenheim, and it said 1818 on it. And I was like, oh my God, goodness, 1818, you know? And so I always like these things. I like the physical appearance of them. I like the fact that I like the paper. And yeah, so I do. I'm lucky enough to live 15 minutes away from Yisrael Mizrahi's, you know, store.
And, are you lucky or is he lucky? One of you is lucky. I'm not sure who.
I think I'm the lucky one, but
oh yeah,
I'm telling you, it's a problem because you know at some point I have to move. You know, and like, I don't know. Well, I still have to, you know, pry me, but yeah.
You'll have to move down here to Tom's River.
Yeah, exactly. Everybody exactly. Always says, move to Tom's River. I'm like, why?
you'll have a place to keep your sorrow. That's why.
That's true. Know? That's true. That's true. I have a nice backyard, but I can definitely use my own. Yeah.
So if someone posted, release the shelfies. You know, when is it getting posted? You're not posting.
Somebody did? Okay, I can post some. So, you know, basically what I remember in that, Arya Kaplan article, part of the thesis was you don't have to be a millionaire to be a collector. And right. He's right. You know, forget about something that's where, you know, forget about books that cost $2,000, Forget about books that cost $400,000. Forget about books that cost $200. I mean, just, you know, you can find something that is within your range, something that somebody else doesn't want or nobody else. I mean, there are books that I want that maybe nobody else in the world wants, but I'm lucky to own them, you know, that kind of thing.
Right. 100%. And like you said, there's someone that you're able that, especially nowadays, people can just, we had him on the other day. You can just go on his website. And there's plenty of different stuff you can get for good prices also.
Sure.
Like you said,
absolutely.
The rarest or worth, if you're trying to just buy books because they're worth X amount. Yeah. That's a different thing.
It's almost a different, passion. I mean, collecting for, as an investment is its own thing, and it's not really applicable to my life. You know what I mean? But yeah, you know, I remember, you mentioned the Mario 9 before. One time I got a copy of the Mario 9 it was the second edition published in Berlin in, I don't know, maybe 1791 or something like that. And there's a whole context behind it. Why it was published at the time and so on and so forth. And it was just, you know, it's wonderful to hold it in your hands.
Well, wasn't that the Musculum claimed him as a Muskel, so to speak, wasn't it?
Right.
That?
Yeah, a prototype, so sure.
Yeah, well, he wasn't. They made up what they thought he was. They projected
That's true, but everybody does that too. I mean, you know, you have, I'm not going to say single people. everybody does that. People find, you know, forebears. And people who represent the things that they're interested in. We mentioned before Chagall. So the Musculum of his time, you know, saw in the Rambam one of their own, you know?
And he was very anti-Rambam's philosophy, right?
He was. He thought that he, you know, a lot of people, you know, so the traditionalists, if I can use that term, when they found out about it, were not too happy. You know, the chutzpah to attack the Rambam and so on and so forth. But the truth is, he wasn't attacking the Rambam, and really, he was attacking his contemporaries,
right.
Who, you know, who idolized certain things in him. But again, this idea of the Moranayim as a maskil, I mean, it's a Shishal Sakabala. You know, you can go into Eichler's and you can find a poster of who are the who created the yeshiva world, right? And they're not going to stop at the Vilna Gaon. They're going to go out, you know, whatever. That's how people are. They see themselves in the past, you know. I mean, I may see myself in some past figures. They don't see me in them, but you know, but I do. It's no harm in that.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
I hear you. Like I said, anyone else has any questions, feel free to ask it on here. I don't know, but they just want to see yourselves as farm now. That's it.
How do I even do that?
Can I open the camera? No, not now. Well, after.
Oh, eventually. Okay. You got it. Okay. Twitter, right.
Eventually. Someone had asked, I don't know if it kind of goes back to what we were saying before. I'm not sure what he wants. Someone asked before on Twitter when I asked for questions. Someone said a suggested reading list. But I don't really know what that means. Do they want new suggested reading list, classic suggested reading list? Not sure. I'm just passing along a question someone asked, but I don't know that it really makes sense.
Well, I'll say this. It depends on what you're interested in. I mean, you know, when I first began I don't even know what to call it, to find myself, you know? So in the beginning, you know, I thought I was interested in everything. And I was, you know? But at some point, you just realize you keep going back to this and you keep going back to that. And you don't go to, you know? I'm not too interested in the medieval period necessarily at least not at the moment. I mean, I am, but that's not my main focus. My main focus is what you would call the early modern period, I guess, the 18th century, the 19th century. I find those two centuries. It's actually funny to think of, you know, I find this century fascinating, but yeah, I mean, I find the 1700s and the 1800s really helpful in explaining how we got here. So that speaks to me. For somebody else, I mean, something else speaks to them, you know?
Right. No, I do. I actually, people ask me, I stop talking about myself, but I don't really, a lot on Twitter seems very popular, modern history, you know?
Yeah, sure.
20th century. It totally doesn't speak to me. I don't read any of that. Most of the stuff I have is on Rishonim or early modern period, a lot of Italian, a lot of that stuff, 15th, 1600s, even 1700s, a little bit the beginning of Maskila, but like, I don't really know much after that. And people always ask me, and I'm like, Chassidus, like, it doesn't interest me. Sorry for everybody. I hope I didn't insult a lot of people into Chassidus, and it's not Chas v'Shalom anti. She's like, whatever. Not my
thing. Right. I can relate to that too. I mean, you know, the truth is, every area of Jewish history, including cultural history, right? You could spend your lifetime on Jewish food if you wanted to. You know, this should not be interpreted as backhanded in any way. But you take a look at Chabad, you know, the type of history that's inspired by Chabad and Chabad puts out. You could spend your entire life analyzing, you know, the tens of thousands of letters of the Chabad Rebbes and all kinds of things. And there are people who that's their thing, and that's great, you know. And there's so many other areas, you know, something for everyone, basically. And also, there's a lot of there's still unplowed fields. It may not feel like it, but like you said on Twitter, there isn't a lot of Rishonim stuff. You know what? Somebody should open up a Twitter account called Rishonim@twitter.com and post fascinating things from the Rishonim. And I guarantee you, you'll find there's a lot of people who are interested in it, right?
They would, but I guess it's because we know less about them. Like, a lot of it's myths and legends. I always found that Avraham Grossman's book on Rashi, like, struck me when he talks about, he, like, deals with the sources, and he's like, we're not dealing with the myths and the legends here. Maybe they're true, maybe they're not true, but we have no way of knowing, so next. Like, maybe that's what people like, hearing actual stories. I don't know if that has
to do with it. It could be. I mean, the truth, yeah. I mean, there's simply more material the closer we get to the present, you know?
Right. It could be. Anyhow, so thanks for coming on. I appreciate it. And okay. I'm sure everyone did as well. And we'll be waiting for the shelfies.
For the shelfies. Okay. All right. Okay, have a good night. Thank you, Mr. Chad. Good night.